I love you. Simon Vodrich, and he's a lecturer and vice principal at Wycliffe Hall, and he teaches preaching and leadership, and has written a number of popular books on interesting topics such as stress. Tonight's talk is going to be about stress, or is titled Stress Without Distress, The Difference God Makes. So please welcome Dr. Weber.
Great, thanks very much for the welcome and for being here. Appreciate the invitation, and I hope that we might have some things to look at tonight that will help you live in a way that makes sense of life and can apply some Christian principles to everyday living. I suppose just making the point that I got into this topic really at a sort of a more popular level. Like you, I live in a world where stress is part of my daily existence. And in actual fact, I had this in my diary for months. But you know what it's like on a day-to-day basis. I walked in and I was teaching for 3 hours this morning, and then I went into our hall council meeting, and I sort of thought, right, I'll give myself a couple of hours just to refresh my memory, to make sure that I'm, you know, on top of my topic and all the rest of it. You know, and that gets squeezed out by bumping into somebody, and then I rushing out the door feeling hugely stressed and thinking, what was it I wrote about again? Because, you know, I can come and teach about this, but actually stress is something that's part of our daily living. We weren't quite sure whether we had PowerPoint. We don't. I have written a little handout that might help you. So just hand that around. And I want to tell you first of all just a very personal reason why I got into thinking about the subject of stress. When I was the minister, the vicar of a church in Buxton, Derbyshire, which was about 10 or 12 years ago now, and did people ever know where Buxton in Derbyshire is? It's a very beautiful town of about 25,000 people. It is the highest market town in England. It is notoriously bad weather. When I got the job, the church warden said to me, here in Buxton we have 11 months of winter and 1 month of bad weather, which kind of about summarised it, because winters are pretty grim. And on this particular winter, it had seemed to have gone on forever. It was March, and it felt like it had snow on the ground for 6 weeks. And you know, like everybody, feeling a little bit run down, a little bit of cabin fever, desperate for a little bit of Californian sunshine, and wanting to get out of winter. And I went to a meeting at church, speaking at one of our senior citizens meetings, and it was very, very hot in the building. And I got back home and I thought, oh, you know, I just feel absolutely boiled. And I went to bed because I was feeling a bit rough and discovered that actually it wasn't just the heating in the church that was the problem, it was the fact that I had a raging temperature. And eventually, by the end of the evening, my wife looked at me sort of shivering and shaking on the bed and called the doctor out. And so the doctor came out, took my temperature and sort of burnt his hand on my forehead, and eventually called the ambulance. And the ambulance took me into Stepping Hill Hospital. And it turned out the raging temperature was caused by pneumonia. And so I had, my left lung was all sort of full of fluid, and I was admitted to hospital, was in hospital for 7 days, and then I was off work for about 3 months. And there are all sorts of things that I could say about that incident, but that was one of the things that sort of sparked my interest in this issue of stress. And I remember the nurse looking at my chart, asking what I did, and I told them that I was a vicar of a church, and she kind of looked a bit weirdly at me and said, but you don't have any pressure in your life, do you? As if to say, you know, surely 6 days invisible, 1 day incomprehensible is what they say of the clergy, isn't it?
Good.
It's right, these are down.
Yeah, yeah.
Not supposed to just write the jokes down. You know, And the thing that particularly got me into the subject was that the hardest bit for me was not being in hospital, it was actually coming back home and starting slowly to recover, but not being well enough for work yet. and being surprised at how difficult I found it when life carried on around me, and people, and actually the church seemed to do remarkably well without me as well. You know, and all of these issues of control and how do you deal with life started to kick in for me. So that was number one, which got me thinking about, you know, what is it about modern living that puts us under this kind of pressure? Here was I living in one of the most beautiful parts of the world, doing a job that I loved, yet actually I put my body under such pressure that, you know, that I'd become seriously ill. After we left Wimbledon at the end of the, left Buxton at the end of the 90s, we moved down to Wimbledon, where I was the vicar of St Luke's in Wimbledon Park, which is at the bottom of the District Line. And most of my congregation there would take the short commute into central London, often working very long hours, would come back home in the evening, often going straight to a church meeting if they were involved in the life of the church. And the sort of the constant conversation that we had with people was just how busy and stressful life was. And it is, isn't it? I mean, living in a culture that doesn't sleep, living in an environment where we feel the pressure on our time. And there was a constant sort of refrain of people, both in the congregation and in the local community, that how do we sort of bring life back under control, because it feels as though we can't wrestle this thing to the ground. So we did a little survey around, this is the first of several surveys that I'll talk about, a little survey around the parish, which we called Stress in the City. And we walked around the homes in the parish with a little clipboard and knocked on people's door. And generally speaking, in England, if you try and do door-to-door visiting, people are very suspicious. They assume that you're either selling double glazing, or that you're a Jehovah's Witness. So actually trying to engage in conversation on the doorstep is quite tricky. But standing there with a clipboard, we would say to people, look, we're from your local churches down the road, and we're just doing a survey on the subject of stress. And people's responses tend to be, stress, tell me about my day. And so it's a very, very simple survey, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. But we asked a number of questions in it, like, how often do you think you experience stress? What kind of things do you do to help alleviate it? Do you have a faith that helps you when you feel stressed? And would you like to find out more? And that result, we gave them a booklet, and then we invited them to an Alpha course, and actually 50 people came to an Alpha course as a result of that survey. And I say all of that because that just gives you a bit of a popular background as to how I got into studying a bit more seriously about the subject of stress, partly my own experience, but also the fact that it was a very relevant conversation and topic with people on the doorsteps in southwest London. And that particular survey, I'm just going to look at my results here, we had, it was about 2001, we had 182 responses from people in the church, and then 180 people from response from people on the doorsteps, and 75 people from within our congregation. I followed this up with a very similar survey in 2013 with students at Wycliffe Hall, and then I also had another survey, of electronic survey using SurveyMonkey, and basically all of those figures together was not a very scientific survey, because actually how do you measure something like stress? We'll talk about that in a minute. But it was really just gave me the sort of feeling that this is a pressure that is not unique to one age group, it's not unique to one gender, it's not unique to one demography, it seems to be a feature of modern life. And I want to ask the question, how can we help people deal with this topic? I mentioned a couple of other surveys, one popular and the only one that I came across that was slightly more scientific. So Hogan Garten Beers did a survey of 2,000 adults in 2005 and asked the people the question, what do you do to get relief from stress? And they made a bit of a splash at the time. It was on the BBC News, and they had a website which they've now taken down. But they discovered that 90% of country dwellers would say they feel stressed on a daily basis. Whereas those who are in urban and city life feel it at 30% on a daily basis. And when asked what were the best sort of stress busters for them, they came up with things like sight of the sea, 42%, walk in the park, 33%, hearing the sounds of birdsong, 14%, smelling freshly cut grass. And they made the not phenomenally staggering conclusion that urban living increases the sense of stress because of noise, because of pollution, because of busyness. But in actual fact, those who are living in rural areas are not completely immune from it. The booklet that we gave to people when we visited door to door was a little one that I've written called Longing for Paradise. And the reason I wrote that is because when you talk to people, they tend to say, look, one day, when the children have left home, or when I've reached retirement, or when I can afford that luxury holiday on that sun-kissed tropical island, then stress will be less. We're kind of always living for another day, as it were. And this little booklet just basically said, we're all searching for paradise, but actually Jesus made a promise to the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. That's the only way, in fact, truly to attain it. But there is something about the fact that being in touch with the creative world does help us connect a little bit with our maker, which perhaps might be reflected in that Hogengaard survey. The only piece of research that has tried a more scientific approach to measuring stress is the one that you have on your handout there, which is one that was undertaken by the psychiatrists Thomas Holmes and Richard Rahr. And they surveyed 5,000 patients over 2 years in order to discover whether or not stress contributed to major illness. And what they did is that they listed, and I put them on your handout, what they called life change units. And they identified 43 of them here. And they asked people to score them according to whether they had in the recent past experienced these things. And so if you look at that list, you have death of a spouse at 100, divorce, marital separation, jail term, death of a close family member, all of these scoring quite high. But even things that actually might be slightly less oppressive still scored on this as well. Change in sleeping habits, change in the number of family gatherings, change in eating habits, vacation scores 13. Celebrating Christmas or Hanukkah, or minor violations of the law. And what they did is that, and they did this over a period of time, so they first of all took the results of the survey, and if people scored less than 150, they reckon there was a 35% chance of illness or accident within 2 years. If they score between 150 and 300, there was a 51% chance of a major illness in the next 2 years. And over 300, they reckoned there was an 80% chance of illness. And in order to test their theories, they actually went back and retested the same group of people to try and see whether that matched up with what they expected to find as a result of stress coming into people's lives. And part of the reason why I've given that to you on your sheet, I'm not going to ask you to do it now, but just as a matter of interest, you might want to just fill that in for yourself. It's quite revealing, actually, to do it. I've done it myself several times, and I'm always quite surprised and slightly shocked at how high I score it. Sorry?
It causes a lot of stress.
Absolutely. Filling in the survey itself is a major stress inducer also. Now, of course, all that Holmes and Ra discovered was what we probably know to be true in our own lives as well, which is that when we put under sustained pressure, then it will have an effect upon us. The illustration that I like to use is of stretching a rubber band. So if you stretch a rubber band and stretch and stretch and stretch it until it snaps, then some people have that experience in their life. You know, a major stressful factor will happen in their life, and they will snap, they will crack up under it. But actually, if you stretch that rubber band, stretch and stretch and stretch it, and hold it taut for a sustained period of time, and then let go, the rubber band, more often than not, will have lost its elasticity and its shape. And often people's experience of stress is more like that, insofar as it's not necessarily the one big pull that's causing them to snap, but it's the sustained pressure upon their life that means that they lose their ability to have focus and to be productive. So what is stress? Well, we sort of know the answer to that question, but do we really? How would you define what stress is? let me give you a few definitions here. So the health and safety executive's formal definition of work-related stress is this: the adverse reaction people have to an excessive pressure or other type of demand placed on them at work. And they make the point that this definition assumes that it's not an illness, but it's a state, and that the state is what is caused when pressure is put upon you, either self-induced or from the circumstances under which you're working. And they go on to make the point that if the stress becomes too excessive or prolonged, then of course physical ailments may result. And I was talking to somebody just last week who had a medical certificate in which they've been signed off of work because of stress. So even there, sort of kind of recognizing that that's the sustained pressure that means that actually you can't perform anymore. Other people talk about the sort of type A personality. Do you know what the type A personality is? You know, that's the person who's very driven, ambitious, and they run on adrenaline. And as we'll think about more in a moment, adrenaline is something that is actually good for you, isn't it? Because I would never be able to play a match of tennis with Ken, which I do on nearly a weekly basis, if a little bit of adrenaline wasn't pumping around my body. And actually, when he beats me, the stress levels go up even higher, I have to say. But, you know, the whole sort of fight or flight language, you know, where you're put under pressure, and that it puts adrenaline or cortisol pumping through your body and causes you to react. That's why we have this phrase, fight or flight. The difficulty, of course, is that in modern living, that stress reaction, that fight or flight, may as easily be caused by a loud bang in the street outside or by the pressure of the commute to work. So the difficulty is that you have building up in your body cortisol or adrenaline with no natural outlet. Now, I think that exercise is one thing that can help. I don't know about you. Anybody got a Fitbit on their wrist? I've just ordered one of those. But on my phone here, I've got a little app, oops, I've just gone off the Bible, which I'm going to come to in a minute, but anyway, which measures my daily steps, which is not bad because the goal is 10,000 a day, and I've actually only done 3,700 so far today. That included walking from Wycliffe to here, so I've got a long way to go.
So you have to walk to Wimbledon, right?
I'm going to get a lot further to get up to 10,000. But there's something about the need for physical activity that is helpful because it gives an outlet to the adrenaline that builds up in us from daily living, and that's recognized really in some of these definitions. I think we all agree that stress is not all bad. We need to be put under pressure. I mean, have you not found that as your thesis deadline approaches and you become somewhat more stressed as a result of that impending deadline, that you also often become more productive? There's something about the pressure that we need to be put under before we produce. Now the question is, how do you manage that so that that doesn't have all this adrenaline floating around your body or cause you such stress within your body that you actually cannot use it productively? The scientists Yerkes and Dodson came up with, you know this, in 1908, what's called the performance arousal graph. And you've seen pictures of this, if I do it from that way around. So you have this sort of graph that, if I have PowerPoint, you can see it, that goes something like this. Because we know that within our performance, there's a sort of sense in which we're put under a bit more pressure and it peaks our activity, but then it falls off very rapidly when the kind of adrenaline is spent or the occasion is passed. You know, so often you've had an exciting weekend or you've had a great holiday, and you come back and you feel flat, don't you? Because that's what the Yerkes-Dodson scale recognizes, is you've peaked your interest and your adrenaline, and then it's gone and fallen away rather rapidly. Now, none of these definitions so far I find phenomenally helpful. They're a little bit technical. And the most well-known definition that's used in all management training books, as well as by physicians, is actually comes from a social scientist called Richard Lazarus, and he talks about stress as a condition when a person perceives that the demands upon them exceed their personal and social resources that you are able to mobilize. Or, in less formal terms, stress is what we experience when we feel out of control. Does that resonate with your experience? Mm-hmm. That is what causes me stress. And that got me thinking a little bit about, and that's really where we'll go with the rest of this presentation, which is, how do I, as a Christian, deal with the issue of control? Because I actually want to be in control, and there's a part of that that is good and helpful, right? I need to be disciplined, I need to be productive in order to get through life and to do things that are useful for myself and society. But actually, seeking to always be in control is not terribly helpful, is it? And knowing a person who wants to always be in control is pretty irritating to know, generally. And you remember my illustration about recovering from pneumonia. That for me, the hardest bit was actually when I started to get better, but I felt out of control because I wasn't well enough to work yet, and other people were controlling what I thought was my domain of work. And coming to sort of a settled point where I could be useful, I hope, in my work and my ministry, but not feel as though I need to always be in control was part of what actually resulted in the writing of this book, trying to come to terms with the fact. And of course, if you throw into the mix what we absolutely must do as Christians, which is, actually, I can't always be in control, but I do know a God who is and can be, and it's for me, it's the confidence that God is in control that I've actually found ultimately hugely liberating. And we won't get there tonight, but I spent 3 chapters at the end of this book looking at Romans 8, which has a very sophisticated theology of God's sovereign rule over the world, and the fact, you know, well-known verses like Romans 8:28, for in all things God works together for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purposes. That verse is tremendously encouraging. Doesn't say that God owes us an explanation for everything that happens in our lives, but it does call us to be confident that God is in control and that he knows the end from the beginning. It also encourages me to think I don't have to be in the driving seat all the time. I can actually relinquish the control of my life into a God who actually is in control. So let me just press the pause button for a moment, because I've talked for quite a bit, and I'm going to talk for a little bit more. But I just want to give you a chance to interact with that definition. It's Monday night, and you've been busy all day, and actually, the adrenaline's been pumping, and now you sat down, and the adrenaline has just all dissipated. Mm-hmm. So talk to me for a second, and just tell me whether you think that this is making any sense, whether that definition of stress is one that rings true for you.
Can you say that definition again?
I can give you the technical definition, but I'll give you my paraphrase, which is that stress is what you experience when you feel out of control. That's my simple working definition. Does that ring bells with people?
I think what's out of control is your anxiety.
Yes.
Because you get very anxious when you don't know what's happening in control.
Absolutely. And that, and I come on to talk a little bit about worry and anxiety in a moment, but that's definitely one aspect, it seems to be, of the control issue. Yeah.
I think it couldn't be complete, I guess, in the sense that if it were completely out of control, I wouldn't be stressed, I would be in despair, I think, because there's just absolutely nothing I could do. So it has to be sort of, it's kind of fussy that way, in that it has to sort of appear almost out of control, but just, you know, enough within your
sliding
control.
Sliding in our grasp. Yes, that's
exactly,
good. And actually, that's a very helpful observation, because actually, what we're doing, I think, when we're stressed, is always seeking to regain control, but it's slightly elusive because, you know, just when I think I've got that sorted, you know, this plate falls over here, kind of thing.
For me, it's also more like a lack of direction, or kind of having too many options, too many choices.
Yes.
So the lacking the sense of where to move or on what basis to make a decision.
Yeah.
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 So
no, that
connected to
that's helpful.
Lack of control, but it's a bit different.
That's helpful. And I think that, so people quite often ask me, do you think that stress is a modern 21st century phenomena, or has it existed before the internet age, before, you know, the kind of pace of living in which we're at? And my answer to that, I think, is yes and no. I want to have my cake and eat it, as usual. But because, for example, if you were to read Psalm 25, and in Psalm 25, David talks about feeling oppressed by his enemies. He talks about the fact that when he failed to confess his sin, that it kind of ate away inside of him. He talks about the fact that his life feels a bit brief, and that there are troubles and anxieties within life. And all of the things that he says there feels quite a lot like modern living and the stresses that we feel. And in that respect, I suppose, we may not have used the word stress to describe it, but people certainly experience what we would say is stress. But there are some factors that it seems to me are very much a part of modern living. And you've mentioned one of them, which is the plethora of choice that we have. Mm. And actually, if you think about your research as well, it used to be, now forgive me if this is oversimplistic, because I don't mean it to be, but it used to be, simplistically put, that we wanted to engage in research. So, you know, we shut ourselves away in the Bodleian Library and read and read and read until we get to a point where we think we've mastered our discipline and are able to understand it, and to then come from our research to actually synthesize it and to write it up and come with our own distinct message, simply put. That's still true. Glad, you know, you're still going to the Bodleian as well. But at the same time, what's happened to us now is that we're just being bombarded all the time. And even when we go to the Bodleian, our mind is crammed full of lots of stuff that we don't want in there distracting us. So it's not so much we need to go and to find stuff. I mean, if you, you know, lived in a rural community 30 years ago and you wanted to find something out, you know, you'd wait until the library was open, you'd go and find it. Today, I get my phone out and I type it into Google. We're not short of information in that respect, but what we find difficult is managing all that choice and actually sifting it in such a way that helps deal with the complexity. It's a rather simplistic view of research, I realise, but recognising the fact that this business of choice and plethora of options is an issue for us.
But I think also you can stress out when there's no choice.
Yes.
I was thinking about Africa. Let's say a woman that has to go in and find food, roots and stuff like that, and there's nothing else but that. She's stressed out because she has to feed her family.
Yes.
There's no other choice. She has to continue digging and digging.
Yes.
So no choice or too much choice.
That's very helpful observation and definitely true. So I think that there are added pressures that come from modern living, but actually they exacerbate things that are there anyway, which is, you know, the frustrations that we feel of trying to live in this world now.
Oh.
So let me give you a few practical illustrations. Those are the things I mentioned in your hand up. And look at worry and anger, ambition, work, rest, and play. And these are four sort of areas that I think illustrate illustrate both the symptoms of stress, but also some of the things that we need to deal with if we're going to reduce stress in our life. So worry, for example, let me read a few familiar verses for you from Matthew chapter 6. I forgot to bring a real Bible, so that's just a little bit on my electronic one. Fortunately, EduRome works up here, so I'm okay. So this is Matthew 6, verse 25, in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not your life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air, they do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they are? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin, yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God chooses to clothe the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Fascinating, isn't it? That 2,000 years ago, when Jesus wanted to speak about living a life in his kingdom, he said that pagans worry about eating, drinking, and clothing. Food, drink, and fashion. I mean, aren't they the things of our modern world as well? Something about the daily essentials of life that can so preoccupy it, whether it be your African mother trying to get enough food on the table for that day, or us maybe presented by too many choices, maybe faddish and aware of the culture around us. But actually there are some very practical things in this chapter. The Sermon on the Mount is Jesus's kingdom rules. How do we live in such a way that we commend the God who we claim to believe in? Jesus assumed that we should seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and actually all these things will be added unto him. That actually if we trust God with the details of our life, then that won't make us inactive, but I do believe it will make us less stressful. Because actually God our King both knows and he cares. Look at the birds of the field. Look at the lilies. God cares for them. They're here today and gone tomorrow. Do you not also have confidence that God cares for the details of your life? Corrie ten Boom has written some very helpful, pithy little phrases. And I love the little phrase where she talks about worry is carrying tomorrow's load with today's strength, which I thought was a rather helpful little comment. Jesus said that do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. It's terribly simple, isn't it? But actually, if I can take on board that teaching, that's not saying I don't plan for the future. The Bible elsewhere talks about planning and being responsible for my family and for my life. But actually, today has got enough care. And therefore, if I can concentrate on today, then I'll have confidence that he can look after me for the future. The little phrase that I like to use is, if you live for today and plan for tomorrow. So make sure that you're not always living for another day, but live for today. But that doesn't negate against the fact that I should plan appropriately for the future. And actually, Peter tells me in 1 Peter 5, 7, cast your anxieties upon him because he cares for you. People get eaten up by worry and anxiety. The person who I mentioned earlier who's just been signed off with stress, for him I think it was the anxiety about his business that was failing. He's got enough money to live on, but there was just that sense in which what for the future? And I don't want to belittle his troubles because they were particularly challenging for him, but I could see in talking to him they've been eating away on the inside. Whereas the remedy that Jesus gives us is to say, take it to your Father who cares, and that will give you confidence that he is interested in sufficient detail about what you eat, and what you drink, and what you wear, to leave that with him. So worry is one problem that's fueled by stress and fuels stress. Secondly, anger. And here I'm thinking about verses like Ephesians 4:26, which quotes the psalmist, in your anger, do not sin. Well, of course, there's some very practical advice there. If you go to bed angry, you won't sin anyway. You won't sleep anyway, you will sin, because it'll be eating away. So there's some very sort of simplistic, practical advice there. But there is also the sense in which this verse speaks about the fact that in our anger, we are to make sure that we're angry for the right reasons, with the right intensity, and with a recognition that we're accountable before God. Certainly Paul seems to acknowledge that not all anger is wrong, and obviously we have Jesus overturning the tables of money changers, we have God being spoken of as being a jealous God in the commandments in Exodus 20. But Jim Packer, I think, quite helpfully says that kind of anger is red not green. In other words, it's not the jealous of the green-eyed monster, it's the red-hot indignation for the honour and glory of God. It's very hard for you and me to be righteously indignant because it so easily spills over into my own personal self-interest being caught up with it as well. Vijay Menon, who was somebody who got to know a bit in London, so some of you may have heard him, as a converted Hindu, great gifted evangelist. He came to speak to our parochial church council when I was a vicar, actually both in Buxton and in Wimbledon. And he gave some very helpful advice to our PCC. And he said something we learned in our church was that when we come together as a PCC to discuss the business, everybody's got an opinion about everything. And we're yakking and discussing and talking all through the night. And our meetings go on for hours and hours. And he said, we turned to each other and said, this can't be right. We're a group of Christians. How can we agree to meet together in peace? So what we decided to do is that we started with half an hour of prayer together. And this is his great little line. He said, we found that once we pray together, all the bees in everybody's bonnet were dead. And so it meant that when we got into the meeting, there was a harmony because actually we'd gone to the Lord first in prayer. Simple advice. But actually, I think that the kind of anger that's spoken of here needs to be taken to the Lord in that way. Sin can be suppressed or repressed. We're all Freudian these days, aren't we? So you can bury it or deny it. It can be expressed, but usually when it's expressed, it's in unhealthy directions. Or better, it can be confessed. And the Bible's remedy for sin in our hearts is that actually sin is removed through our mouths. So we confess our sins, and God is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Two more, and then we'll have some discussion. Thirdly is ambition. So we mentioned with this definition of control that ambition is something that we recognize can be greatly used by God. If you're a Hudson Taylor and you've gone to take the gospel against all the odds to the land of China, the many people oppose you, but if you didn't have that ambition, that driving gospel mentality that it was the Apostle Paul's, then you'd never have got out of bed and done anything. So there must be an ambition that's right and helpful. But we also know that ambition is something that eats away inside us. We don't get the recognition that we think we deserve. We don't actually achieve our own targets, let alone the targets of perfection. Then it gets us frustrated. I've had a verse of scripture that has been kind of, as much as anything, has been my life verse, as it were. And it's from Philippians 1:21. For me, to live is Christ. To die is gain. And I've preached on that verse quite a lot over the years. And during the first few times that I preached on it, my wife would sidle up to me afterwards and she'd say, Simon, darling, the way you preach that verse is just a typical man. Because you so talk about the fact that you want to die and be with the Lord in heaven that you just want to escape all your responsibilities here on earth, don't you? But of course that verse is very balanced, isn't it? Because it talks about a reason for living and a reason for dying. For me, to live is Christ. And Paul says in Philippians chapter 1 that if I remain here on earth, it will be fruitful labor and be for your benefit. While I'm alive, I'm ambitious for God's sake and for his kingdom. But I'm not investing all of my value and all of my worth in this life, because to die is gain, because that will be to go home and to be with the Lord. And that seems to me has been so helpful in seeing just a biblical balance, that while I'm here on the world, while I'm labouring on this earth, I will be ambitious for his sake. But I'm not going to imbibe the mentality that he who has dies with the most toys wins. It's not all about this life, because actually to die is gain, and then I'll be home with him. And then, just very finally, there's plenty more we could say, but how about work, rest and worship? A little bit about the whole sort of Sabbath principle. That within God's created order, he has set a rhythm of 6 days labor and 1 day's rest. And you may have read of the various experiments that have gone over the years, trying to sort of change the shape of the working week so that you don't do 6 days of labor, but you do, for example, after the French Revolution, they had the decade, the 10 days of labor before you got any time off. And they found that actually after 10 days of labor, people were A, becoming less productive, and B, becoming sick. That actually there's something in the human rhythm of 6 days' labour and 1 day's rest. And if you look at the two accounts of the Decalogue, there are two motivations for the Sabbath, one in Deuteronomy and one in Exodus. So one of them, it's because the Lord spent 6 days creating the world and on the seventh day rested. The other is that you remember the Lord your God who brought you out of captivity to slavery in Egypt. And so the two motivations, it seems to be, in the two sets of the Ten Commandments are God's created principle of enjoying the good world that he's given. So you enjoy the fruit of your labor for 1 day a week. You don't work the whole time. The second is that, particularly for believers, we remember that actually God rescued us from our sin, and therefore we spend a day, now not on the Saturday but on the Sunday, celebrating Jesus rising from the dead. There's your theology of Sabbath in the space of about 2 minutes. We can spend a whole evening on that one. But I take from that actually it's good for everybody to break that rhythm. 6 days of labour, 1 day's of rest. Well, interesting, what you'll find is that you'll have six more productive days of labour if you take 1 day properly resting and enjoying his created world. And actually for us as believers, it's a chance for us to pause and to thank our Lord. There's one final verse I want to mention in this connection from Matthew chapter 11. I love this verse because to me it speaks about how God offers us rest. Matthew 11:28. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And it's this wonderful picture of, you know, of two yoked oxen. And Jesus is giving this picture, you know, at the moment he says, you're burdened by the load that you're carrying. Come to me and I will take your burden upon myself, and in return you'll take my yoke, my burden, which is easy and light. And he offers to swap burdens, as it were, to carry the weight of life on his shoulders so that we do not need to carry the weight on our own shoulders. Okay, so let's talk together a little bit, but before we do that, I've just given you a very sort of fast flying bird's eye view from 10,000 feet. So it's a big subject. But at root, for me, is all got to do with this issue of control. So, to what extent am I supposed to be in control of my life? And how does it help remembering that God is sovereign and he's in control and knows the beginning from the end? So that's one question I want you to think about. And the second is a much more practical question. I want you to try and think about the most stressful day that you can bear to bring to mind. Okay, so whether it's just that awful day at work, whether it's that day that you're on the train and it broke down, you were stuck there for 6 hours, whether it's about that phone call about a family member who's died or whatever it might be, think about a very stressful day and then think about some of the principles that we've just been enunciating. Is there anything in what we've been looking at in this last 3 quarters of an hour that might enable you to deal with that situation and to actually manage the stress any differently? Okay, so I want you just quiet just for a minute, just to think about this business of control, this business of how would you manage that very stressful day in the light of what we've been thinking about in recent minutes. And then we'll open up the conversation. Okay, so over to you. Where would you like to go with the conversation from here? What we
makes you smile.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's a really good thought, actually, is what made me sort of think about things. Going back to sort of first time when you were asking about, are we more stressed, I think, now than, you know, I can sort of identify when you said yes and no, is kind of, I think what I started reflecting on, and it was interesting because I was going to bring it up, and then you brought it up right at the end about the Sabbath, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, when I was a kid, it was like I grew up in a generation where you couldn't do anything on Sunday. You know, it was the whole lifestyle was.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I thought it was a bit boring, actually, because I love sport, and it was like, you know. But actually, it's quite interesting now. There's no, I just think that's sort of characteristic of our society, isn't it? There's no Sunday where there's no now, and it does seem as though whilst there was stress before, we are more stressed, I think, I would say, you know, in this kind of, you could argue there's less freedom by not doing it, kind of having to do things in kind of shops and not being, I mean, shops weren't even open on Sunday, did it do our society, was it doing it better, because our society was built around, a Christian model.
Yeah,
and
actually lots of the public discussions about introducing Sunday trading and things like that happened, 15, 20 years ago now? Yeah, they're more than that, is it? Probably 25 years ago.
Yeah,
20 years. And there was a lot of discussion about, you know, what right do we have to impose Christian principles on a, you know, multi-faith culture, etc. But probably the most persuasive argument in all of that for me was, well, no, we don't want to impose Christian principles, but there's something about this wiring business, so the creation rather than the sort of worship principle, that actually how can I have a Sabbath, my one day off, if the whole world around me is busy and active? So I keep a sort of, as far as I'm able to, a kind of Sabbath my principle in, try not to answer my emails and try not to do any work for one day a week. But actually the whole rest of the world around me is awake in the buzz. So the strongest argument that we never won the day was, you know, how can you have a 24/7 culture? Because then nobody will get any rest at all. And that's kind of what we live in as well. And there are other more practical implications. I mentioned email, but I mean, these things are both a blessing and a curse, aren't they? You know, so you get an email at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning and, you know, there's an expectation that you'll have read it and hopefully replied to it before you get into work on a Monday morning. That's just the world we live in. They're great, I like mobile phones, but they also just make it harder to disconnect and to rest in the sort of 24/7 culture.
Have you come across any of the research that suggests the obesity problem in the West is actually a result of stress without scarcity? It's not so much the calories and the fizzy drinks and whatnot, but for most of the last 100,000 years, stress was caused by a lack of food, and so our bodies, when they get stressed, presume scarcity, slow our metabolism down, store fuel, and our obesity is actually a result of this conundrum that we still have stress, lots of it, but not scarcity.
Yes, absolutely. It is fascinating, isn't it, that you would think that I'm under pressure and I'm too busy to eat kind of thing, therefore I will waste away. But ironically, as you rightly point out, that it has the opposite effect on people because it makes them, it slows down their adrenal system, it makes them less active, and then they get into that cycle of putting on weight. I mean, it is worrying and a modern trend, isn't it, that?
Another thing I just wanted to ask. In addition to control, which I agree is a huge part of the issue, I personally find that actually the burden of responsibility for others is an even greater stressor.
Yes.
And I wonder if thought about that or done any work in that area.
No, that is very interesting. And certainly, you know, I think I would say as a parent, you know, with older parents alive, you're very aware that that you have responsibility. And I think that it falls in that domain of feeling a sense of responsibility for something that I actually still can't always manage or control. So the burden of either looking after young children or elderly parents or sick friends is you want to be engaged and active, but I can't fully meet their needs. That's the kind of stress that I think that gives you, and perhaps the relentless burden of perhaps actively caring for somebody on a day-to-day basis. So yes, it is a particular manifestation of, I think, something that still comes down to this business of not being able to be fully in control, because I can't be God to that person. I cannot, as much as I would like, I can't actually meet all of their needs. I went last week to Ravi Zacharias's and Vince Vitale's book launch on the latest book on suffering. So you need to get Vince to come and speak here if he hasn't done already on his new book on suffering. And there's a really helpful section in this new book on why, if you know that your child is going to suffer, why would you bring them into the world when you know that every child is going to suffer in some way, and actually ultimately all do because we die? And the interesting answer that I thought was helpful in what they said is that we, as parents, as our parents thought about us, don't think that the burden of suffering in this world is so great that would stop you bringing in a new generation, because actually in the midst of all of that pain, love is still manifested. And goes in some way to help sort of make sense of, you know, why God might actually still allow us to exist in a world where there's suffering and not intervene every time. But actually it's not unrelated to the thing, to the point that you make there as well, that there is pain in love, and just by loving doesn't relinquish the burden that one feels in that kind of relationship. So I think I agree with you, really. It's just, it's all part of the conundrum, I think, of living in this way in this modern world.
But I was thinking that that's what the Bible stresses so strongly, that we have to live in a Christian community so we all can take care of each other and share our burdens.
Absolutely, yeah.
And also when you talk about self-control, it's one of the fruits of the Spirit.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we learn how to do it with the help of the Lord, because that's very hard to do.
Yeah.
But little by little, he helped us to learn how to do it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. And I do agree with that. In fact, I have a little section on the fruit of the Spirit, because I remember hearing John Stott preach on the fruit of the Spirit, that, you know, you have the ninefold fruit, and it's interesting, it starts with love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, etc., etc., ending with self-control. And I very remember him saying that, you know, love, described in the Bible with this Greek agape word, is self-giving. It is God giving of himself generously to us that will result in us generously giving to other people. And in order for love to happen in that way, you need self-control. So you need, in order to give of yourself, yourself needs to be under control for you to give out. And God gives that to those of us who are in relationship, the ability to not feel totally out of control. Actually, that's because we've been brought under control. Under his, you know, taking his burden, as we were just saying from Matthew 11.
Because he's not all about us.
Exactly.
Or me.
Indeed. And that's, to me, that's hugely relieving. Yeah. How do you cope with stress if you're not a believer? I mean, that's the fact that God is ultimately in control is what is the biggest relief in all of it.
I was just thinking about that, bear one another's burdens and fulfill the law of Christ. But there are times when we have stress because we want to be a Messiah complex. I want to bear everybody's burden, but I have to be willing to give up my burdens to a brother or sister to share them to the Lord. So that frees me up to take on something. The problem is when there's no reciprocity.
Yeah.
When you're either getting loaded down or something, or you want to give away anything, but you don't want to pick up anybody else's, because it doesn't work that way. There has to be that interchange. An exchange in order for people to grow and to be realistic too about what you could take on.
Yeah.
Because if you're sick or something like that, well, then you can't take
exactly.
on this kind
yeah,
of thing. Somebody, they have to go somewhere else and see the pastor is taking care of himself and pray for him. So we have to have the wisdom to know to balance. It's a balancing act all the time. Always renegotiating what you can do and what you can control and then kind of resting in God.
No, that's really helpful. And I think this sort of self-care in the mix there is important. I'm no use to you if I am unhealthy or I'm unproductive, you know, so there's a sense in which that...
I had two things I was wondering if you could comment on. The first was the rubber band analogy.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, and it's the first time I've heard that. And I was wondering, the idea that, so you said, it's not so much the stretch and the snap problem as it is the stretch, and then it just sort of stays in position. Mm. I was wondering if you could just explain sort of the reality behind that part of the analogy.
Because yeah.
I just thought that was really interesting. I'm kind of sort of perhaps, you know, applicable to my own life. And then the second point was what, so there's this sort of ability, or this, we need to learn how to trust God and to sort of lean into Him when we're kind of at our limits, I guess. But what if, what about those situations that are these kind of, I mean, maybe you, some people face them, you know, maybe only a handful of times in your life, but when you're sort of really at your own limits, and it's not clear what you ought to do or what God's calling you to do. And so it's just, I guess it's that much more challenging to be able to kind of release oneself to God, because it's really not clear what, you know, what He may have. But I guess I'm trying, that just sounds maybe like the same question as, but do you know what I mean? The kind of situation where it's particularly unclear.
Okay, let me have a stab at it.
Yeah.
So the first one, you know, the stretch from a band, and that often our experience is more like it being stretched than held at sustained limit. I mean, we, you know, why do you break the speed limit when you're driving off on holiday? You know, why would you do that? What's the rush to get there on holiday? But, you know, most of us are just, you know, we got the gas pumping and that's just how we live our life, you know, with the foot on the pedal the whole time. And actually, the why I use that illustration, it came to me with a particular poignancy when I was in SW19 in South London, you know, where lots of my congregation and the people living in the parish were, you know, leaving. I remember coming back from an evening meeting at about 11 o'clock, you know, and there were people still in their suits just getting off the tube and going home. And I also remember going to set up for a men's breakfast meeting on a Tuesday morning at sort of about 6:15 and seeing these same people going off to work. I was thinking, good grief, you've been at home for less than 7 hours kind of thing. And one of the features that I think was particularly noticeable in some of the city ministries was that the young ambitious men and women would do that for say 20 or 25 years. And then it just all got too much, you know, and so in their mid-40s, they may not have made their million, but they couldn't continue that kind of pace, you know, because they're always up when the markets were open, and then there was always a market that was still carrying on after you got to bed, you know, and just living in that intensity. So that's the sort of thought I've got with that level of intensity. And, you know, I love being in the open air, things I think I've already mentioned, but I went with a friend and walked up Scarfell Pike in September, and I mean, it was beautiful. It was actually a lovely sunny day, and we were very fortunate, and we were walking up. And I was just trying to take in the beauty of the Lake District all the way around. But I noticed that my mind was almost unable to focus, and I was kind of thinking, yeah, that's beautiful, you know, kind of, it just, I couldn't take it in, because I wasn't used to walking at walking pace. I mean, I wasn't used to nothing to stimulate me like a mobile phone or computer screen or whatever, or TV, but actually only the natural world. And that's what I mean by that stretched rubber band. You know, and have you not found the experience I have as well? You go away on holiday or vacation, and it's about just about time to come back before you've really properly unwound and not been thinking about work or whatever, because it takes often that long for us to get back into a slower pace of life. Now again, don't misunderstand me, because I want you to be productive, I want to be productive, and I want to be ambitious. But we kind of live with the pedal half depressed all the time on the accelerator in our life.
So it's not necessarily permanent, I guess, in the sense, but it sort of has a lingering effect.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it's also in the relation to this business of sort of producing adrenaline, and that's why I think it's impossible to have a balanced life. So let's not kid ourselves that you'll ever have this perfect balance. We'll always be striving for it. But I want to say, don't give up trying. So Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, be perfect because your Heavenly Father is perfect. Your Heavenly Father in heaven is perfect. And I've often thought, this is a bit unfair of Jesus, isn't it? I mean, do you really have to set the bar that high? And I remember mentioning this to a pastor friend of mine. He said, well, you know, what did you expect Jesus to say? You know, be 83% kind of thing. You know, no, he's going to say be perfect. Now, so God sets the standards at an impossible height, but he also provides for failures. And we kind of live with that conundrum. We are never going to attain perfection, but actually that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive to live a life that is best reflecting it. And I think we will, you know, we'll never get it right. And one of the things I hope to do in this book is to don't make this another project. I don't know, really sort out stress and put all my energy into it now, but actually try to look at the kind of lifestyle that is more biblically balanced, so we're not living at the same intensity the whole time. I'll tell you what, let me take his question, and then you can think of your question, because I haven't quite got it. Maybe you re-articulate it. And then he'll come back to you. Yes, sir.
What do you say to Wycliffe students when they're stressed about their work?
Yeah. Praise the Lord. Get on with it. So there's a sense of... So my point is not that stress is bad, okay? I think we're probably agreed amongst ourselves that there's something about the deadline, there's something about having that sort of schedule that makes me focus and intense. And, you know, if you're not breaking into a sweat while you're a student in Wycliffe, then I'm probably doing my job wrong as a tutor, because there should be a bit of that going on. But what I would want to say is, if you have no life outside of study, or if you have committed yourself, I realize I'm talking mostly to DPhil students here as well, who probably have done this, if you've committed yourself, you know, and study is your whole world forever and ever, and you're never getting out to do anything else with what you're studying, then actually you need to perhaps evaluate whether you got things in perspective. And if students are not chomping at the bit at the end of 2 and 3 years wanting to leave and get on with it, then we've probably not done our job quite right. So please don't misunderstand me. I think that stress has a useful and important function to play in our lives. Without it, we kind of just don't do anything of any much use. But it's what you do with it when you produced it that is important. So is it being dissipated and put to use? And have you got a sense of rhythm in your life where you're not living at that same level of intensity all the time? So my life verse, Philippians 1:21, I want my students to go away with that. I want them to be ambitious for God. To live is Christ, but also to realise that the prize is eternity with the Lord in heaven.
Do you have any students that are not procrastinators, that do last minute? Do you have
I don't have any students who aren't procrastinators.
Because some of them study
ahead,
and they're not stressed by the time you get there.
That definitely helps.
Yeah.
Yes. So, disciplining yourself is important.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got eight essays to write a term, actually there is a schedule for writing them. But I did study with somebody when I was doing my theological training, who we only had an end of year deadline. And in the last 2 weeks of the year, he literally shut his door, study door, and didn't emerge just for bodily functions, and wrote all of his essays in that past 2 weeks. I mean, I think I would probably have had a heart attack if I'd have left it to that, but it seemed to work for him. Not sure it's the best way. Mm. But I think that, you know, Jesus doesn't say don't worry. He actually says don't worry about tomorrow. And Paul does talk about making plans for the future. He does have an ambitious schedule. So, you know, again, let's not misunderstand each other. So there is a place for planning, there is a place for organisation, there is a place for working a disciplined schedule. But it's how do you deal with the pressure that's upon you, but actually sometimes you can avoid it by being more organised, as you rightly point out. Yeah.
This has been asked. The question has made ask me to reflect on the Londoners you're describing, because I'm still not sure about this feeling out of control. Like I get it to a component, but I feel like there's something of my own experience, or in trying to look at stress in the world around me, that doesn't seem. It's not exactly that, but I'm not entirely sure what it is. But it seems to me to be something around the fact that so much of our kind of modern world doesn't have any prescriptions. Or any sense of time or pathways, that there's a sense of you move through something, that there's this, as we were speaking earlier, this proliferation about choice, and that therefore the pressure is on oneself to have meaning, to make these choices. And so it's very hard to without some kind of like clear paradigm or view of faith on which you kind of map your life, where it's going and in what direction and for what purpose, for what end, that you kind of are in so much control of the kind of day-to-day life, but also trying to navigate why what you do is meaningful. And so I was just thinking, like, these Londoners, is the core stress, of course it's stressful if you're working from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. at night, there's like, and the physical manifestation of that stress, but is it not the kind of stress too of when you do come home or you engage with someone outside of that bubble and you're asking the question, what am I doing? Like, I have a few very dear friends of mine who are working in like very competitive corporate environments. And every time we meet for a drink, it's like these same big questions emerge for them. Like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And that seems to be like, that seems to mingle in with the daily pressure of the corporate environment that they're experiencing, which is not my experience. And I'm just wondering how you see those kind of, those two pressures kind of mixing together, and how much of it is a lack of control versus actually feeling like you have to be in control and you determine the basis on which something is meaningful.
No, that's really interesting. So, not convinced I got a complete answer to that, but it's sort of the micro and the macro in some respects, isn't it? So the kind of people we're talking about have a focus of this deal has to be done, this deadline has to be met, this will put me under intense pressure, and there's a bit of me that thrives upon that. But then many people don't allow themselves to step back far enough and say, what is the sort of big picture? I mean, I completely resonate with the questions that your friends are asking, which we found happened a lot. So people would come to inquirers' courses, so long as they get away from the sort of thought that you're going to turn me into a churchgoer or you're going to pin me in a corner. They actually do want to ask the existential questions about what is it all about, what's the big purpose rather than the micro purpose of what we're doing, which gives you some opportunities. And I'm not at all going to suggest that the reductionist level that you talk about control and lack of it and that's the answer to everything. I think that actually the kind of scenarios you're talking about is people who do need help to make sense of how do the little bits of life fit together with the big plan for life, and how do I get a sense of that? And sometimes it seems the only way that God breaks in on those scenarios is by waking them up. I mean, it can be a positive thing, it can existential thing, looking at a beautiful sunset, being out in God's world, getting out of your environment in some way, having a baby born to you as a family, or it can be illness or some of my plans getting unpicked. But often it seems to be in those scenarios, it takes something to jolt people awake, to say, okay, I'm here on this treadmill, going round and round and round, on a daily basis, which is giving me purpose for this month, possibly for this year, possibly for this short-term career plan, but what ultimately is the big purpose? It sort of kind of spreads out from there. So,
I guess I'm just thinking about, again, that image of the elastic band, like if the result of being pulled like that for a sustained period of time is your inability to see, to make sense, that more macro stress.
Yeah. And that definitely, and we do suffer from a kind of myopia where we feel like we're on the treadmill and therefore we can't see things in any perspective. And how often, you go away, isn't it sort of fascinating, you go away on a holiday and you rehearse in your mind some of the things that have been stressing you out. And with the benefit, as long as that doesn't stress you out too much by thinking about them, but with the benefit of being away, you see things in a kind of perspective that you were unable to do when you were up close to it, because you feel the intensity of the moment that you're in. And doesn't mean we have to go on holiday every other week in order to get that. Somewhere or other, we need to gain that sense of perspective in life, I think.
Do you think so? On that theme, in the church, when you were a vicar of folk that went into the inner city,
right?
Did you find a challenge that does the church say enough that actually this sort of lifestyle, how biblical, how Christian is it in fact? Because, you know, if you look, think back to the sort of, you know, you look in the Bible and you don't see that kind of lifestyle, you know, within Jesus' time, or you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, so you ask the question, how biblical, how Christian is it?
Yeah.
You know, as a model even, and is the church saying enough in this perhaps? I don't know, is it?
Well, for me, I think I tried to address it with, you know, with talking about things like ambition. How do you work out whether the ambition you've got is healthy or unhealthy? I mean, so I think about some believers who had equally very stressful jobs, but actually they really had a sense of the money that God had given. They used very generously for causes and things like that. So I wouldn't want to be too blanket in saying this is right or wrong. But I do remember a conversation, it was all part of this process of doing the stress survey amongst the parish, was that one of my senior men in the congregation came up to me after a sermon I preached and said, Simon, we love your sermons and find them very helpful, but you know the zing is coming. But we find that all of your applications either go to personal morality or church life or family life. But I spend more of my waking time at work than I do in any of those other scenarios. So what have you got to say to my working world? And I think that was a legitimate and a serious challenge to my preaching. And I didn't have any magic answers there, but I did say to them, I think that's a really good point, and what I think I would like to do better, I had a short career in banking, but long since faded into distant memory at this point, but I'd like to understand your working world better. And in actual fact, this was a great strategy. I highly recommend this. So what I agreed to do is that I worked my way around the men in the congregation. I met them. Forgive the sexist way I did this, but I'm a man talking to men. Mm-hmm. There were women who worked as well. I went up to the city and met them in their workplace. And usually, to boot, I got taken out for a very nice lunch, so I did very well out of this. And actually, all that happened, so there's one guy who worked in the House of Commons, there was a guy who was a money broker, you know, and a lawyer, and you know, what all these kind of professions you'd expect. And so I went up and met them at work, they showed me a bit about their work, we had a nice lunch, and I went back home. And I can honestly say to you, it was probably one of the best things that I did in my time as a vicar. Not because I was sitting there taking notes saying, yeah, I can use that in a sermon, you know, but it was just something about I entered into their world rather than constantly expecting them to come into my world and just helping having a conversation with them. So there was no magic cure in that respect as a vicar, but there was just something about connecting the world of church life with the working world that both the men and the women in the congregation were experiencing there, that it's not easy. Say, because often the decisions you make in these arenas are not right or wrong, they are judgment calls as to what's best in this occasion, and that's where complexity comes in. And being able to better understand the world in which you're making those decisions, I think, is useful. Yes.
I think I have my question.
Okay, cool. So just send you back for another question. It's the opposite to what tutors usually do, they send you off for another answer.
Yeah. The sort of scenario I'm thinking of is one in which, say, there's a moral question there's no clear answer to, and something, you know, like, say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, should I participate in this assassination plot against the Führer? In that case, you know, he has sort of moral reasons for and against, and, you know, discerning God's will is not, it's not very straightforward. Whereas, you know, say I lose my job, or my career is, you know, sunk, it's sort of a different, we're kind of in a different zone, because in that case I learned to trust God and you know, I can't control my future and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, you know, I really have to wrestle through a deep moral problem, and it's not clear what to do there. So I was wondering if in that kind of situation, it seems a bit more challenging than the other ones. Is there a strategy for maybe coping with stress and those kinds of kind of deep existential, more moral situations?
Wow, yeah, good question. I was waiting for the D-Phil philosophy question. Does it come up every time, you know? that's a really good question.
I mean, it just seems like there's no easy way out.
Exactly.
There, right? And it just seems like, wow, okay, like there's really nothing that you can say. I mean, I don't know if there is, right? But it just seems like you just kind of have to suffer through it.
And I think that, I mean, I hope I haven't painted a false picture here, but it seems to me that we live with complexity, don't we? I mean, the most of life that we live is hard to say. It's matters of judgment. It's rather than right or wrong. We do have right or wrong decisions to make, of course, all the time, but we also have judgment calls to make all the time, and that causes tension because you still wrestle with, was that the right thing to do? This had these implications. If I had done that, was also a different judgment call, would have had those implications. So I do think that there is some, which of course you see going on in Bonhoeffer's life. I mean, there are things that you do as Christians that it seems to me help you live better with that tension. Doesn't completely resolve it. Didn't help David completely resolve in Psalm 25. So it's like I say to people with the suffering question, the Bible does give you answers to the question of suffering, but they're not simple answers. They don't take away the complexity, they don't take away the pain of suffering if you're experiencing it, but nevertheless it helps me by knowing a theological answer that actually does begin to make sense. But that's not the same thing as removing the pain. And I think that the area of kind of complex decisions that you're making there, there's a sense in which the believer will prayerfully make decisions to move in a certain direction. All other factors being equal, this seems to be the right thing to do. But there should be, I think, a provisionality to our decisions in those areas if they are matters of judgment calls. And I do think that God is not standing over us with to beat us with a stick if we've gone down a wrong path when, in good faith we've attempted to follow a way that we think is honouring to him. And to be aware of the fact that others may think differently, and we actually might change our decision on things that are those kind of complex decisions. It's a very hypothetical answer, because I can't honestly say for the most part I've really been had to deal with something as big as that, but in the course of ordinary everyday life we all deal with those kind of grey areas of not knowing whether this is right or wrong, but actually is this the best, the wisest way, as opposed to the least good or the unwise way to go, and most of life is lived like that.
Would you say that stress, and would you say that distress is simply stress with a hypotony of it, or would you say that distress is qualitatively different from stress? and a follow-up to that would be, do you find in your experience, in your experiences, that perhaps if it is qualitatively different, that idolatry is often at the root of it?
That's an interesting question. So distress would be a combination of feelings and adverse circumstances that mean that we lose our sense of focus, that we feel out of control, is that word again, that we feel that life doesn't make sense. I don't know that I had particularly, I gave you a title that was just supposed to pique your interest. I wasn't trying to suggest that stress and distress were on a continuum somewhere or other. With respect to the idolatry question, I think that at the macro level, our prime sin is idolatry. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbour as yourself. This is the first commandment, is to love God and Him alone. And therefore, whatever takes me from that as the prime focus is idolatry, whether it be the worship of no gods or the worship of other gods in the Old Testament story. And essentially, idolatry is also harmful and self-destructive, because my heart is restless until it finds its rest in the true God, as Augustine would say. So I think I can't quite get at the answer, but I think what you're getting at is right insofar as, you know, the path to peace is to have a focus on a true God and to live our lives in harmony with his will and his ways. The opposite to that is to have a life that is out of harmony with the true God, which by the Bible definition automatically will mean that I will worship that which is not God, which as a result will mean that I will reap not blessing but actually cursing and distress, if you want to use that language, as a result. So I think, you know, those kind of macro terms do make sense with tying in with the rubric of the Bible, that idolatry is not only wrong but it's also destructive because it focuses off of the purpose which we've made, which is to worship and love God. Does that help at all? Just wrestling a little bit with your question. It was a good question.
Any final questions?
So when you asked a lot, so.
Wow, gosh.
Thank
very
you so
good
much.
Question.